Knowledge Products presents Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Part 8.
Marx died in 1883, a few years after the death of his wife and a few months after the death of one of his daughters. A small band of friends gathered at the graveside, among them the ever-loyal Engels.
On the afternoon of the 14th of March, at 3:15, the greatest living thinker ceased to think. Left alone for less than 2 minutes, when we entered, we found him sleeping peacefully in his chair, but forever. As Darwin discovered the law of evolution in organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of evolution in human history. The simple fact, previously hidden under ideological growths, that human beings must first of all eat, drink, shelter, and clothe themselves before they can turn their attention to politics, science, art, and religion. But not only this. Marx discovered the special law of development of the present-day capitalist mode of production and of the bourgeois system of society which it has produced. With the discovery of surplus value, light was suddenly shed on the darkness in which all other economists, both bourgeois and socialist, had lost themselves. For Marx was, above all, a revolutionary, and his great aim in life was to cooperate in this or that fashion in the overthrow of capitalist society and the state institutions which it has created, to cooperate in the emancipation of the modern proletariat, to whom he was the first to give a consciousness of its class position and its class needs, a knowledge of the conditions necessary for its emancipation. And therefore, Marx was the best hated and the best slandered man of his age. Governments, both absolutist and republican, expelled him from their territories, whilst the bourgeois, both conservative and extreme democratic, vied with each other in a campaign of vilification against him. He brushed it all to one side like cobwebs, ignored them, and answered only when compelled to do so. And he died, respected, loved, and mourned by millions of revolutionary workers from the Siberian mines, over Europe and America, to the coasts of California. And I make bold to say that although he had many opponents, he had hardly a personal enemy.
In fact, Marx made quite a number of very bitter enemies, but the part about the millions of revolutionary workers was true, or would be true very soon. Even before Marx's death, support for communist ideas had begun to grow rapidly on the European continent, most strongly in Germany. The word communism, however, dropped out of use in favor of socialism. The word communism was hardly used at all until Lenin revived it in 1917. From around 1880 until 1917, all Marxists called themselves socialists and regarded the term communism as an old-fashioned word, no longer in use, but meaning the same as socialism. Before Marx's death, the socialists began to increase their votes in the German parliament, and Marx was greatly encouraged by this development. In the parliament of the new German Empire, the Second Reich, males of all classes had the vote, though representation was heavily biased in favor of the wealthier classes. But the parliament had very little power. Real power lay with the Kaiser. Germany industrialized rapidly, with a strong growth in the number of factory workers. Overwhelmingly, except in the solidly Catholic areas, these workers became socialists and voted for the Social Democratic Party. At this time, the terms socialism and social democracy were almost interchangeable, Nearly all Marxists would describe themselves as socialists or social democrats. They called themselves revolutionaries. By this they meant that they wanted a transformation of society, not necessarily accompanied by violence. Like Marx, they saw this democratic revolution as being carried out by the majority of the population, who were bound to become supporters of socialism. Like Marx, the social democrats were opposed to terrorism or minority insurrection. The Social Democratic Party consisted of both Marxists and anti-Marxists, but the Marxists steadily defeated the other socialists in argument. The Social Democratic Party reached a point where Marxism became the party dogma, and all its discussions were conducted in Marxist terminology. In 1887, the government commenced a vigorous campaign to stamp out socialism, and for some years the persecution of socialists was more intense, though socialist candidates were still permitted to run for parliament. But the persecution failed, and perhaps even strengthened the socialists. In 1890, the government became more tolerant, and in the elections that year, the Social Democrats, now almost entirely Marxists, tripled their vote, becoming the largest German party, a position they maintained until the rise of Hitler. But although the biggest party, they never received majority support. We now think of Marxism as consisting of minority conspiracies and barbaric Asian regimes. But we should remember that Marxism would have little importance today but for the fact that it gained the support of the majority of industrial workers in the world's most highly populated, industrially advanced country by means of open argument and persuasion under a system of free elections. Marxist socialist parties were also very strong in France, Austria, Italy, Belgium, and elsewhere. But in Germany, the Social Democratic Party was the biggest, best organized political party the world had ever seen, and it was more like a church or a way of life for hundreds of thousands of working class members. Its chief intellectual, Karl Kautsky, interpreted the works of Marx and Engels in a dogmatic fashion, like the articles of a religious creed. Kautsky became known as the Pope of Marxism. On the surface, it seemed that Germany was developing in exactly the way Marx had expected. The working class was becoming larger, more powerful, and apparently more embittered against the ruling class. But beneath the surface, the Social Democrats were reconciled to capitalism. Most of the workers who voted socialist did not want a revolution. They wanted to go on as they were, getting higher wages in a prosperous Reich. They wanted the Social Democratic Party to help the labor unions pass various measures of social reform and introduce democracy. Meanwhile, the intellectuals who wrote in the party press preached undying hatred of the capitalist system and advocated a revolution which would abolish private ownership and introduce the Marxian version of socialism. This tension between pragmatic reform and revolutionary Marxism came to a head in the movement known as Revisionism, led by Eduard Bernstein. Bernstein was a seasoned revolutionary, often imprisoned for his socialist beliefs, who had known Engels personally and was thoroughly versed in Marx's ideas. He came to the conclusion that these ideas were inadequate and wrote a book about it, published in 1899. The title of the English translation is Evolutionary Socialism. In his book, Bernstein presents arguments rejecting, in a friendly way, some of the major tenets of Marxism. He rejects the labor theory of value and the prediction that wealth is becoming concentrated in fewer hands. He suggests that property ownership has become more widely diffused, that the working class is becoming reconciled with established society, that the business cycle will probably become less violent, and that only gradual piecemeal changes in society are warranted. On the question of industrial concentration, Bernstein cites statistics to show that whatever concentrating tendencies might be at work, they are counteracted by the growth of small and medium enterprises.
If in Germany, in the near future, the state wished to expropriate all undertakings, say of 20 persons and upwards, be it for state management altogether, or for partly managing and partly leasing them, there would still remain in commerce and industry hundreds of thousands of undertakings with over 4 million workers, which would be excluded and carried on under private management. In agriculture, there would remain, if holdings of over 20 hectares were nationalized, of which no one dreams, several million holdings under private management, with a total of 9 million workers. What abundance of judgment, practical knowledge, talent for administration must a government or a national assembly have at its disposal to be even equal to the supreme management or managing control of such a gigantic organism?
All of Bernstein's revisions were furiously denounced by the orthodox Marxists under Kautsky. In the teeth of the facts, the orthodox Marxists reiterated every item of the Marxist creed, sometimes with adjustments to make the creed fit the facts. For instance, here is Kautsky in 1902 defending the Marxist prediction that small businesses would all be snuffed out by competition.
Small industry is doomed to ruin. Its ruin is now proceeding uninterruptedly. This shows itself only slowly in the actual diminution of the number of small firms, but rapidly in their demoralization.
In the immediate debates over revisionism, the old guard of dogmatic Marxists won out all along the line. The party members sprang to the defense of their traditional principles. Despite this, Bernstein's arguments represented the way the Social Democratic Party and all Marxist parties in all countries where they could operate openly were actually behaving. They were revisionist in practice. In 1914, the International Socialist Movement, powerful in many countries and predominantly Marxist, faced a challenge. Marx and Engels had stated in the Communist Manifesto, "Working men have no country." Many socialists had come to take it for granted that the workers would not be nationalistic in outlook, but would unite across frontiers to oppose war, even by sabotage and general strikes. But when war broke out in 1914, the socialist workers nearly all lined up behind their respective governments. Many of the Marxist leaders, like Kautsky, opposed the war, and so they simply lost their positions of leadership. When it became clear that Germany was going to be defeated, the German high command handed over power to a democratic regime. But after many mutinies and uprisings, power was assumed by an entirely socialist supreme body. The socialists who took power found themselves in a difficult position. For years, they had been attacking the measures of nationalization and economic controls, known as Zwangswirtschaft, or coercive economy. They had been proclaiming that socialization, the introduction of socialism, would be entirely different. But now they were in power. As one observer of these events, the economist Ludwig von Mises, described them,
"Now real socialization had to start. But what did socialization mean? It was, said the Marxians, neither the kind of thing represented by the nationalization of state railroads, state mines, and so on, nor the war socialism of Zwangswirtschaft. But what else could it be? Marxians of all groups had to admit they did not know. For more than 50 years, they had advocated socialization as the focal point of the party program. Now that they had seized power, they must start to execute the program. Now they had to socialize. But at once, it became apparent that they did not know what socialization meant."
The socialists could not agree among themselves on what socialism was or what steps should be taken to get there. After an inconclusive period, they handed power to a broad democratic parliament, which became the Weimar Republic. The indecision and uncertainty of the Marxists, their violent revolutionary rhetoric, and inability to bring about the transformation of society they had promised, played a part in the rise of Hitler. Meanwhile, Russia was a predominantly backward country. Industry was developing rapidly in some areas, but 80% of the population were wretchedly poor, illiterate peasants. Before 1917, Russian Marxism was very similar in its doctrines to German Marxism. Lenin, the leader of the small group of Russian Marxists known as Bolsheviks, had begun his Marxist career as an admirer and follower of Kautsky. Before 1917, all Marxists, including Lenin, believed, as Marx had stated, that the full development of capitalism must come before the socialist revolution. The socialist revolution would take place first in the most industrialized countries, Britain, Germany, France, and the United States. In countries like Russia, which did not have political democracy, the first aim of Marxists was to press for a democratic republic. After the Russian Tsar had been overthrown, a democratic system was established in Russia, and great freedom prevailed for a few months. But Russia was losing a desperate and unpopular war against Germany. To the amazement of nearly all other Marxists, who thought he must have become a lunatic, Lenin suddenly started to oppose the democratic regime, and he advocated pushing ahead with an immediate socialist revolution. Many Marxists had become disconcerted that capitalism was not developing as Marx had expected. Competition was not destroying itself and creating monopoly. As a substitute for this process, some Marxists had begun to argue that state regulation of the economy in wartime showed the way to socialism. This was a theme taken up by Lenin and his followers. Lenin argued that state-controlled, state-regulated capitalism was already close to socialism.
If a huge capitalist undertaking becomes a state monopoly, it means that the state directs the whole undertaking. In whose interests? Either in the interests of the landowners and capitalists, in which case we have not a revolutionary democratic state, but an imperialist republic, or in the interests of revolutionary democracy, and then it is a step towards socialism. For socialism is merely the next step forward from state capitalist monopoly. Or, in other words, socialism is merely state capitalist monopoly which is made to serve the whole people, and has to that extent ceased to be capitalist monopoly.
Support for Lenin's party grew rapidly because of the war and the appalling conditions in Russia. Although the Bolsheviks never gained the support of the peasants, the great majority of the population, they did attract considerable support in the towns. The Bolsheviks were able to stage a successful coup in November 1917. On the day that they took power, Lenin announced that they would proceed immediately to construct a socialist society. At first, the Bolsheviks believed that successful socialist revolutions would sweep across Europe. But as the years passed, it became clear that Bolshevik Russia was isolated. The Bolshevik Party changed its name to the Communist Party. And later, communist parties were set up in almost every country of the world. In contrast to the old Marxists, who had been committed to democracy and free speech, these new communist parties imitated the Bolsheviks' methods of unparalleled ruthlessness, violence, and dishonesty. However, most members of the old Marxist parties, which had been substantially open and democratic, denounced and detested this new heretical form of Marxism, now identified by the old name, communism. It was communism, Bolshevism, the Marxism of Lenin, which survived as the only important form of Marxism. But what the communists were doing in Russia had little to do with the ideas of Karl Marx.
This concludes Knowledge Products, Karl Marx, Das Kapital.